eyes, the blood train to rot. Are you ready to be shot? Do we want a war? Anybody listening? Haven't we learned anything? What's the point of killing when it hasn't worked before? Before the final culture clash, before this fragile piece is smashed, before we all do something rash, back it up. Situation simmer, nothing to consider. Implications of a war, nobody will win. Fundamental chaos, fighting for the right to use God's name and everything related to the cause. Everybody, everybody breathe. Everybody, everybody believe. Before we step right off the edge, before we are at war in the end, before we start to count the dead, back it up.
Everybody breathes, everybody believes.
We elect the ones who choose, how many they're prepared to lose. Put in power, supposedly, to rescue us from death's decree.
Everybody breathes, everybody believes.
Theological debate collapses into racial hate. Faith has made us dumb and blind to the future of mankind. We all breathe, we all bleed, we all share the basic needs. Draft by color, place of birth, you're on this team, so pray it works. Debate collapses into racial hate. Faith has made us dumb and blind to the future of mankind.
Everybody breathe.
Yes, stop. What your country can do for you.
Everybody breathe.
Yes, what you can do for your country.
Watch the camera on the world, keeping you and me involved.
Okay.
Being fed what to believe, with no control of what we see.
Okay. Everybody breathe. Everybody.
Okay.
Everybody breathe. Everybody.
Hello and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program starts out with The Sins of Wall Street. Bloomberg News financial journalist Bob Ivory talks with Francesca Bianan about his book, The Seven Sins of Wall Street, Big Banks and Their Washington Lackeys, and the Next Financial Crisis. Bob Ivory says the sins of Wall Street are size, secrecy, pride, greed, impunity, complexity, and immunity from adequate regulation. And then after that, climate risk for real estate values in South Florida. Biologist Phil Stoddard is the mayor of South Miami, a South Florida suburb threatened by rising sea levels. Mayor Stoddard tells Steve Curwood that municipalities in Florida are doing all they can to prepare for climate change, but he does not think the state government is taking the issue seriously. The risk to real estate values is considerable.
Street to America. Heads we win, tails you lose.
What happened since the financial crisis, and why I write about a subversion of democracy, is that private obligations became public obligations. So, heads I win, tails you lose. If the bank makes money, the bankers get the money. The bankers get the profit. If the bank loses money, taxpayer makes up for it. This is the essence of too big to fail and why too big to fail is considered unfair.
That's financial journalist Bob Ivry. We spend the hour with him talking about his book, The Seven Sins of Wall Street, Big Banks, Their Washington Lackeys, and the Next Financial Crisis. That's all coming up on today's Fighter's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When it comes to crying needs like affordable housing, healthcare, living wages, cleaning up the environment, and supporting schools, we always hear, there just isn't enough money. But when it looked like the big banks were about to go under in 2008, the U.S. government had no trouble rustling up $750 billion in a couple of days to bail them out. Over the years since, the Federal Reserve has added several trillion to that, practically giving money away to the banks and then buying it back at a higher price. Banks and their casino economy are even bigger now than before. Now they're not just betting on subprime mortgages, but on commodities like electricity and metals that determine the prices of basic goods. And as always, the U.S. taxpayer is on the hook for bailing them out when things go wrong. My guest, Bloomberg financial reporter Bob Ivry, says it all amounts to a leveraged buyout of the U.S., where Wall Street is making out like bandits while the rest of us shoulder the risk. In his terrific book, The Seven Sins of Wall Street, Ivry lays out in scorching prose what's been happening since 2008 and why we're headed for another financial meltdown unless we break up the big banks and put an end to too big to fail. Ivry skewers the banks and the feds while sharing the compelling stories of whistleblowers and ordinary Americans who fought back against corruption and injustice. Bob Ivry is an investigative reporter for Bloomberg News. His articles have won numerous awards, including the George Polk Award in 2009. BusinessInsider.com recently named Ivry one of the 101 finance people you have to follow on Twitter. I spoke to him in May, before two foreign banks, Credit Suisse and French bank BNP Paribas, settled criminal charges with the U.S. Department of Justice. The case came into our conversation, but the story has advanced since then. Bob Ivry, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
In this wonderful book, Seven Sins of Wall Street, you write that the financial crisis that we went through, the meltdown of 2008, we call it a financial crisis, you say, but you say it was really a leveraged buyout of the United States. What do you mean by that?
There's an expression in banking, and it's credited to the billionaire J. Paul Getty. And he said, if you borrow $10,000 from the bank owns you. But if you borrow $10 billion from the bank, you own the bank. These banks, these six banks that I talk about in Seven Sins of Wall Street, borrowed a lot more than $10 billion from the United States government and the Federal Reserve. And it was in the best interests of the government and the Federal Reserve that these banks not only survive but flourish. And the Federal Reserve and the U.S. government have done all they could and more to make sure that the banks thrived, even as the rest of America didn't.
We haven't even recovered on the housing front yet.
Well, you see that the houses that are the upper end of the price scale are doing very well. And the homes that are in the middle of the price scale and at the low end of the price scale aren't doing that well. And that should give you an indication of really what's happened since the 2008 financial crisis. There's been, I call it economic apartheid in the book, and I think that's kind of an incendiary expression. But I think that more as we get farther and farther away from 2008, I think you can actually say that, and it's an accurate description.
Say a little bit more about that.
Well, you really have had two economic recoveries in this country, one that's gone apace and the other that hasn't. It's lagged. And you see that in the work of Tom Piketty, the French economist, who has just written a very good book about that. I've read most of it. I haven't read all of it yet. But he describes that there really was an acceleration after 2008 of income inequality. Wealth, we've always had that. We've always had wealth inequality. But now, ever since the financial crisis, we've had an acceleration in the widening of the gap. So you see that the U.S. government and the Federal Reserve decided very early on that in order to get the country's economy going, they needed to stimulate the banks. That's the decision they made, and it worked out well for the banks. It hasn't yet really worked out all that well for the rest of us.
We started out talking about housing. Mortgages is one of the topics of your book, The Seven Sins of Wall Street. The U.S. taxpayer guarantees 9/10 of the mortgages. How do we come to that pass?
As I say in the book, mortgages before the crisis of 2008 were really royally screwed up by the banks and by the government. Since then, probably more so, and I mean more screwed up by the banks and the government. One of the things that precipitated the crisis was Wall Street making loans to people who couldn't pay them back, bundling all those loans into investments that they then sold around the world. And when more and more people couldn't pay back their mortgages, those investments collapsed and led to a chain reaction that nearly brought down the entire financial system of the world. Since then, we've been living with that legacy. And what happened was that the Wall Street decided that they weren't going to do that anymore. That left it to the United States government to be the guarantor of all those mortgages. So what we've had is the taxpayers have basically taken on not only the liabilities of the biggest banks, but have also slipped into the role that the banks used to have. And the banks and also mortgage insurance companies like AIG and other mortgage, for instance, mortgage banks like AmeriQuest, Countrywide, which in the early part of the 2000s were notorious for their fraudulent practices. So what's happened since then, because we still want people to buy homes, we still want people to be able to borrow money to buy homes, is the U.S. government has stepped into that role. And so that's how we find ourselves in this predicament now, is that how do you have a financial system where people are able to borrow money to buy homes without the private sector really being involved anymore? The public sector has moved in and done that.
Access Sacramento broadcasts great speeches and interviews every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., or you can get the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Our blood runs blue, we're loyal men and true, the hope of a new generation. But we don't speak too well, we can't read or add or spell. California couldn't pay our education. Rooms each fall were crowded wall to wall, resplendent in squalid privation. And our texts were first rate back in 1958. California couldn't pay our education. And 3 years on, when they noticed we were gone, they showered us with consideration. And they transferred our files to the Hall of Juveniles. California couldn't pay our education. They had a great music teacher. But he got laid off. Now we've got great jobs. I stock the salad bar at Bob's. California couldn't pay our education.
The proprietor of our local liquor store refused our request for a donation. But we changed his mind with a crowbar from behind. California couldn't pay our education. They locked us away for 3 years and a day, completing our alienation. But we learned from those men how to not get caught again. California finally paid our education.
And now back to the Sins of Wall Street with Bob Ivory and Francesca Rhiannon.
And is the public sector doing any better in some ways than the private sector? That is, are people being able to get mortgages that they actually can pay back? And how does that kind of intersect? I mean, it seems that there's a little bit of an ongoing collision between the fact that incomes are not rising and people are still trying to get homes.
It's interesting because my colleagues at Bloomberg News had an article this week about how people are rating 401ks, the retirement funds. And they called the retirement funds the home equity of the 2010s. What happened because of stagnant wages for the middle class and the working class was people would use the appreciating value of their homes as a way to keep their standard of living improving. So if they wanted to pay for juniors' college education, or they wanted to buy a boat to enjoy themselves in the summers, or a vacation, or maybe they needed to put a new bathroom and a kitchen in their house, they would take out a home equity loan, which was just fine because home prices were always going up. When home prices stopped going up, that's when the crash basically happened. So now, without that home equity cushion that people have, they don't have that equity in their homes anymore. Home prices are not going up enough for them to make up for what they lost. They're raiding their retirement funds. I'm going to tell you one more story, and it's included in the Seven Sins of Wall Street. I became acquainted with a whistleblower for Citigroup, City Mortgage. Her name's Sherry Hunt, and she was in charge of making sure that Citigroup was buying and selling mortgages that were up to snuff. And anytime there would be she would take a sampling of the mortgages and take a look and see if it had all the paperwork that she needed. Because if it didn't have the paperwork, or it didn't have certain things signed, or the bank account that was in the mortgage application didn't match your employer or your name or what, she would flag fraud, and she would just flag mortgage applications that were incomplete because those mortgages might not be kosher.
So these are those kind of the liar loans.
Some of them were the liar loans, but it was more that if there's whiteout, because what City Mortgage did was it would buy mortgages from independent brokers who weren't always on the up and up. And she had identified maybe 60% of the mortgages coming in for Citigroup to be shady. And what Citigroup was doing with these mortgages was it had a relationship with the Federal Housing Administration, and it would get guarantees from the FHA that if the borrower quit paying, the federal government in the form of the U.S. taxpayer would come in and make up the difference. And so these loans were guaranteed by the U.S. taxpayer, and it was up to Citigroup to say that these mortgages were fine and good and give them the stamp of approval and let the FHA guarantee them. A lot of them were not good, and Citigroup was actually had pleaded guilty to defrauding the FHA. So I went to the FHA and I said, "What's up?" I talked to the general counsel there, and she said from 2009, when she first got there, until March 2012, when I talked to her, the FHA didn't really check any of those mortgages. It relied on Citigroup and the other FHA lenders, Wells Fargo, JP Morgan Chase, the big boys. Everybody knows who they are, the big mortgage companies, Bank of America. And this was astounding to me that the taxpayer could be on the hook for billions of dollars, but at the same time, the watchdog for the taxpayer, the FHA, didn't bother to check that the mortgages that the taxpayer was guaranteeing were any good. And she assured me that starting about that time, that they would start checking the mortgages that were coming in. But I'd like to circle around with some of Sherry Hunt's colleagues and find out if that's true.
And you haven't done that yet, but what happened to Sherry Hunt?
Sherry Hunt, you know, it's very difficult to win one of these lawsuits. She sued Citigroup as an employee under the QITAM provision. QITAM provision comes out of the Civil War, and it says that an employee whistleblower of a company, if it sees and has evidence that the company is defrauding the U.S. government, can sue that company on behalf of the taxpayer. A lot of these suits happen. Very few of them succeed. One thing that improves their chances of succeeding is if the Department of Justice comes in and sues alongside the whistleblower. Sherry Hunt had amassed such a volume of evidence against Citigroup, so detailed and so damning, that the Department of Justice came in and sued Citigroup along with her. They won the lawsuit. Citigroup had to pay back, I think, $170 million. And Sherry Hunt got $31 million of that as a reward before taxes and her lawyer's fees. But this was a working-class woman who did not have a college education, who just decided that right was more important than her career. And she really did risk her career. She could easily have been fired and forgotten. And she would be working who knows where at a convenience store or something like that. But she did risk it all because she felt that being right matters more than being rich.
And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Bob Ivry about his book, Seven Sins of Wall Street, Big Banks, Their Washington Lackeys, and The Next Financial Crisis, which we will get to. Now, the Dodd-Frank bill was supposed to address the problem of too big to fail, to basically take the taxpayer off the hook, and to prevent future financial meltdowns. What's happened with Dodd-Frank?
What's happened with Dodd-Frankenstein? A lot has happened with Dodd-Frankenstein because it's, depending on how big your font size is, it's 700 pages or 1,000 pages. What I like to say is the Obama administration never saw a problem that they didn't want to throw a committee at. So what Dodd-Frank does is it lays out the parameters of what they want financial regulation to do post-crisis, post-2008 crisis. And then it leaves it up to the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, all these regulatory bodies to make up the details of the rules. What that's really done since 2009, or actually 2010 was when Dodd-Frank went through, is allowed the banks to pay lobbyists lots and lots of money to try to influence the details of the regulation. I think that a lot of folks who I agree with on a lot of other things are very excited about Dodd-Frank and think that it's done a lot to ameliorate the whole problem of too big to fail. Now, too big to fail, all that means is that the U.S. government can't afford to let one of these big banks go under, because if they did, it would imperil the entire financial system of the world. One of the corollaries of too big to fail is too big to jail. And Attorney General Eric Holder in 2013 told the Senate that he was worried about prosecuting any of the banks because they were too big. And he was afraid that any ill effects of that prosecution would ripple through the financial system and really cause damage to ordinary people who needed a loan or wanted to get their money out of the ATM. He since, a year later, almost to the day, says, well, wait a second. We're going to try to prosecute one of the banks. The two banks that he is reputed to be going after are Credit Suisse, which is a Swiss bank, and BNP Paribas, which is a French bank, for what they've done in the United States as far as, I believe, money laundering and tax havens for American citizens. What he hasn't done is, well, he hasn't done it yet anyway, and it remains to be seen whether they really truly will prosecute those banks. But he hasn't said that he would go after an American bank for doing the exact same things. And there are American banks that have done the exact same things. So did Dodd-Frank get rid of too big to fail? I'm going to reflect that question back to you. If Citigroup, which handles the overseas accounts of the U.S. government, were to suddenly get in trouble over some weird investment, or J.P. Morgan Chase were to take savings account money from American citizens who put their money in savings accounts in Chase branches and lose billions of dollars on very complicated, kind of silly bets on whether or not, say, American Airlines is going to go under, and loses this truckload of money, teeters on the edge of failure, do you think that the U.S. government will allow capitalism to proceed as it usually does, where badly managed or bad luck companies go under naturally, and their shareholders lose everything, and their bondholders fight over what's left, the desks and the buildings, and they liquidate and send it over to the people who've lent money to this bank? Do you think the U.S. government and the Federal Reserve will allow that to happen? I'll say no. I don't think that too big to fail has been solved. I think we still have that problem.
In this address, FDR answers his critics that have accused him of a breakfast menu that includes grilled millionaires.
You may have heard for 6 years that I was about to plunge the nation into war, that you and your little brothers would be sent to the bloody fields of battle in Europe, that I was driving the nation into bankruptcy, and that I breakfasted every morning on a dish of grilled millionaire. Actually, I am an exceedingly mild-mannered person, a practitioner of peace, both domestic and foreign, a believer in the capitalistic system, and for my breakfast, a devotee of scrambled eggs.
And now for something completely different.